Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of January 13th, Friday the 13th, 2012. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has a new chief. His job is to help protect you from bad financial products, but he also wants you to protect yourself.
We want to both simplify and clarify the marketplace to make it manageable for consumers, but at the same time, we want consumers to have the power to make good decisions for themselves.
We'll talk with the CFPB's Richard Cordray. And Suze Orman has a new show on Oprah's network and a new prepaid debit card, but she's got something else on her mind.
In 3 years, I'll be 63, almost 64. And so at that point in time, I want to go around the world on a boat that I helped captain.
A chat with the diva of dollars. And what if the economy just got one big do-over?
Forgiving debt is the only way to get things back on track.
A proposal for stemming the tide of red ink. Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
2 weeks down, 50 to go. Hope 2012 is shaping up to be a good one so far for you. Let's say we had the New Hampshire primary this week, but let's assume none of you were living in a cave and you've heard the news out of that event. Congress is still on vacation. Wouldn't we all like to have that kind of time away from the office? Well, let's hear what else made news this week from our intrepid senior business correspondent, Marketplace's Bob Moon, who joins me in studio. Howdy, Bob.
Hey, Tess.
First, I have to start with a story that I believe will be very close to your heart because I've seen its products on your desk more than once here at Marketplace. The Twinkies bankruptcy must have you in tears.
Yeah, we covered that this week. And, you know, I brought this
in. Oh, no,
in
you didn't bring any.
Yeah. Can I interest you in a ding-dong?
Call me a ding-dong.
Well, you know, people have been talking about the end of Twinkies, but I have graduated here. I discovered this morning that there is something called a Hostess Chocodile. And what it appears to be, let's
a chocolate crocodile?
It appears to be a chocolate-covered Twinkie. Oh, so good.
Please don't eat that. No, don't eat that.
That's really good. Okay, so anyway, hopefully
don't
Hostess...
Don't talk with your mouth full.
Hopefully Hostess will be able to get out of bankruptcy and life will go on.
For you.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of poor sales.
Not what happened over the last year in 2011. Record retail sales.
That's right.
Oh, Bob, what recession?
Well, we had $4.7 trillion in retail sales.
Good Lord.
But then again, you have to think about that number because this is a very broad gauge that the government uses. It not only pertains to department stores and grocery stores and that sort of thing, but it also includes auto dealers. It includes your trip to the gas station, it includes restaurants, it includes bars, and health care costs. Our spending on health care goes into that retail number.
But the fact is, it still set a record last year, so we're spending more money than ever, apparently.
And some economists told me getting less with that money that we're spending. So in other words, one of the reasons that number was so high was because some prices that aren't included in the government's gauge of inflation do get included in that bottom line number for retail sales.
So what does this tell us about the overall health of the economy? Anything?
One economist I talked to said if you went into this report looking for a sign that the economy was improving, you could have justified that. And if you went into it saying, well, the economy is slowing down, you could have justified that because right at the end of December, sales really dropped off. So it appears that consumers backed off of their spending binge during the early part of the holiday season. And in fact, Wells Fargo economist Tim Quinlan told me that he has one big concern.
There's also some evidence that consumers really stretched in order to enable the decent holiday spending that they had.
Stretched, as in plastic.
Yes, lots and lots of debt. And in fact, that's another number that we did see this week, which is that credit card usage just skyrocketed in November.
That's right, although economists can also see that as a positive sign because that might signal that there is increasing demand out there for goods and also that consumers do have a willingness to spend.
On their credit cards.
Well, that's right. Apparently, consumers also dipped into their savings a little bit early in November. That's when, apparently, the holiday shopping season was front-loaded. Many consumers apparently did most of their shopping early on in November, and so that's why sales tapered off in December.
I guess that's because there were all kinds of sales. I mean, you know, you started seeing advertising for holiday sales even in October.
Very early. Yeah. Holiday sales around Halloween.
So just to sum up, when we look at these two figures here, is there any way to predict what that means for us going forward here in 2012?
There is some thinking that it could mean that consumers have pulled back a little bit. They're not going to load up their credit cards. They are trying to be a bit responsible. But on the other hand, it could mean that spending is not going to be quite as strong in 2012.
Okay. Except for you and your spending on these Hostess ding-dongs that you
get back to this here. It's a really good test.
Oh, gross. Marketplace's Bob Moon joining us. Thanks a lot. Bon appetit.
Thanks.
Imagine taking a job and then getting threatened with a lawsuit the day you start. Well, that is the situation for Richard Cordray, new chief of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Last week, President Obama used a recess appointment to usher Cordray into office. But a lot of people are asking questions like, was the Senate actually in recess? And that could mean a slew of lawsuits as Cordray starts to take action. But he's moving ahead, and he joins us from his office in Washington. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
First of all, I know you're a five-time Jeopardy champion, so I'll be giving you answers, and then you can respond in the form of a question. Does that work for you?
That keeps them short, too.
It certainly does. I think what most people know of the CFPB up to this point is that the agency has been trying to simplify a lot of paperwork around everything from credit card statements to mortgage applications. What would you say are your top three priorities right now?
Well, I would say that continuing that work is a high priority, the Know Before You Owe project, because what we find is that consumers in the marketplace often are baffled and confused by a lot of fine print, by offers that are hard to follow that may be potentially misleading or deceptive to them. Cleaning that up, simplifying and clarifying language is quite important so consumers can make better informed decisions that they can live with. At the same time, another priority for us, and important now that we have a director, we could not do this before, we can now police the non-bank arena. We saw this in the mortgage market in the lead up to the financial crisis. Many mortgage brokers and others were not held to the same standards and principles of law that the banks were held to, and they undermined the market, and it really destroyed the mortgage market in a way that the country, unfortunately, is still grappling with the residue of that crisis.
And payday lenders, would that be another one?
Yeah, as part of the broader universe, enforcing the law, holding people accountable, examining these institutions, making sure that they understand that they have to both obey the law and that they have to treat their customers fairly.
As Ohio Attorney General, I know you did a lot of work on the foreclosure issue, taking action both against, you know, the scam artists who were saying that they could help people with their problems and also trying to get the banks to clean up the process. Now at the CFPB, what do you think needs to be done in that area? And what do you have power over?
Well, the good news is that going forward, we have broad power over the mortgage market, including mortgage servicers and, frankly, the fraudulent scammers who have caused so much harm. Some of those mortgage servicers were bank-related. Some were non-banks. That marketplace was very fragmented before. It was a broken model that didn't work very well. Going forward, we will have three types of authority over the market. Number one, we can supervise these institutions directly. We can send examiners in. They can get access to all the information they need, and they can work with the institution to correct problems very quickly. Second, if need be, and we have the authority to bring enforcement actions to enforce the law. Third, we have the ability to write rules that can govern the entire market rather than taking institutions just one at a time. So we have a very good set of tools to address the problems that really brought this country to its knees in 2008.
But what about the current foreclosure crisis? Not just the things that happened to get us here, but do you have any way of pushing the process that banks are currently putting people through? Do you have any way to clear out what is still a very big mess in the housing market?
We do have some authority. Our authority is more prospective than it is retrospective.
Yeah.
However, in terms of mortgage servicers, whether they are treating their customers properly, some of the advancements that are now being made to ensure that there's a single point of contact, that there are not parallel proceedings where somebody's trying to get a modification being foreclosed upon at the same time, there are going to be adjustments there. But the problem that happens is you get a major crisis like we had. There's a lot of unfortunate consequences. We can't really undo the building that crumbled. What we can do is make sure that the markets work better. And there are certain things we can do about the ongoing problems that can make them better, yes.
Mr. Cordray, where do you draw the line when it comes to consumers being responsible for protecting themselves, caveat emptor, versus needing the government to help protect them? At what point is it up to us to make sure that we read the fine print and understand the terms of a mortgage?
I've always been an advocate that it's both things. I think there's a role for consumer protection. But at the same time, consumers have to take responsibility for their own decision-making. People have to be able to protect themselves. But when people are in the marketplace and they're being victimized by fraud or terms are being hidden from them, it is, you know, not always easy to know the details of everything that happens at our mortgage closing. So we want to both simplify and clarify the marketplace to make it manageable for consumers, but at the same time, we want consumers to have the power to make good decisions for themselves.
You mentioned financial literacy, and I know as Ohio State Treasurer, you wanted it to be a requirement of high school graduation, particularly through the Office of Financial Literacy there within the Bureau. What can you do as head of the CFPB to make financial education a priority?
We did succeed in Ohio in making it a requirement for every high school student. They had to have personal finance education before they graduate. Many children, unfortunately, do not get good guidance on this at home. So this is a big part of our new watchdog bureau to help empower consumers across the country. Financial literacy will be a big portion of that and other things as well.
Richard Cordray, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tess. Thank you.
And while the CFPB is doing what it can to rein in financial industry abuses, we're looking for a family that reined in its own financial abuses over the last couple of years. For a story connected to our next collaboration with the New York Times, we'd like to talk with a family that completely overhauled the way it handles money because it was basically scared straight by the financial crisis of 2008. Maybe you were in a house you couldn't afford, you had credit card debt, cars that didn't match your income. Had things gone wrong, you could have been in really big trouble. But instead, you changed everything from how you spend to how you save and how you think about money. If that sounds like you and your family, drop us a line. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Haven't seen you since January 1st. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Off we go, 2012. Feeling good.
It's going to be a good one, right?
I'm pumped.
I'm glad you're pumped. Well, let me tell you something that happened to me this week. My New Year started with someone ringing up $7,000 worth of fraudulent charges on my credit card.
Ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho. Oh, my goodness. Not pretty. But I tell you, I wanted to mention this because I think it's always good to remind everyone that you can find this stuff out for yourself. You don't need to pay for credit monitoring services. I check all of my accounts at least once a week, if not twice a week. So I caught it myself and caught it early enough that it wasn't a problem.
Well, you're raising a good point, and that is that no one is a better cop for your privacy than you.
Exactly.
And if you don't stay on top of it, really nobody will. And you're a multiple victim of identity theft.
I am. This is I think this is four or five for me.
And I've been down that same road. I've got to two or three. I've lost track.
Yeah.
I mean, in one case, the guy who stole my identity, I had to chase him down myself.
Ended really?
Up getting him arrested and deported.
Holy cow.
I'm a crime fighter in my spare time. You know that. I mean, I just could not get law enforcement involved. So I had to do all the work, which ultimately got him arrested and then deported.
Oh, my goodness.
And yet now he's back in his native Jamaica, still with my Social Security number.
So, oh, dear.
Yeah, have a nice time in Kingston, you know, my little Social Security number.
This was just someone somehow got my number, my credit card number, and charged up, I think, a bunch of furniture at a design store in Chicago and some time at Disneyland Resorts. But, you know, I think the lesson here is that in many ways, there's really nothing that you can do to completely prevent this from happening to you.
The watchword here is vigilance. You have to be careful because
yes.
There are very, very organized crime rings that do this, that acquire people's credit card numbers, personal data, print up plastic. A lot of them are based overseas.
Right.
It's very, very difficult for our law enforcement to go after. Moreover, and this is a really alarming number, only 1% to 2% of all identity theft cases result in a conviction.
Wow. Right.
And so that means you do have to stay on top of it. Now, you're smart to look at your credit card information online. But, you know, I would also say for anyone who is a victim of identity theft, immediately sign up for some sort of credit monitoring. Now, if you want to be absolutely sure, you need to monitor all three of the major credit agencies,
right.
Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. But just keeping tabs on one of them will give you a good pulse reading if there's anything untoward out there.
All right, let's go to the phones. And Doug is on the line from Washington, D.C. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you, Tess?
Very well. And David is with me here as well, if you want to say hello.
Hi, David.
Hello, Doug.
So, let's see. Are you a politician? Do you work for a politician? Do you work in the government or something else?
I, like most people in the area, I work for the federal government.
Uh-huh. What do you do?
I'm a librarian.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's cool. I was thinking at first, okay, another grimy politician. But no, he's a librarian.
I am a librarian, yes.
Well, so what's on your mind today?
Well, I received an interesting letter in the mail this week trying to get me to sign up for a debt mediation notice. And the company is Credit Arbitrators.
You know, this is really weird. Hang on. I just wondered, I'm working on a column for the LA Times right now about this company.
Really?
I kid you not. In a nutshell, if I may, Doug, Credit Arbitrators, they offer a debt mediation service whereby for 12% of what you owe in your outstanding balance, they say they will approach your creditors and negotiate, if they can, to bring that cost down.
Hmm.
And they say that since the mid-1990s or so, they have addressed over $200 million worth of debt.
Is this what your letter said?
It did. So it gave me an account number and an estimated balance, and I'll talk about that later, and what my estimated savings would be.
Huh.
The thing that sort of surprised me was that about a month and a half ago, and just basically who this company was and why they were marketing to me, I had a ding in my credit report about a month and a half ago because I signed up for Equifax's notification services.
Huh.
And said there was a name change on my account.
Name change?
And a name change. So I was worried that someone was opening up a credit card in my name.
Yep.
So I went to their online dispute. It was resolved, and the name change was the first initials of my first and middle name, which I only have listed on one single credit card, which is my American Express, which I've always had. I've had it since 1993. It's the first credit card that I ever opened up.
Okay.
And I said, and the letter was addressed using this. And
using the name from the Amex card.
Yes. And I thought, is this Equifax? Because the sort of estimated balance was somewhat what I owe on my credit cards. And I was like, is this Equifax trying to market? I mean, yeah, I was alarmed. I was like, how do they know my estimated balance on my credit card? And why are they marketing specifically to me using this sort of variation on my name. And I was like, who are these people?
So it's not like you've had a collection agency coming after you or anything like that.
No.
It's a solicitation. And I got into this through the same door, and that is a reader sent me probably the same sort of mailer that Doug got. And it's kind of scary looking. It's an official looking mailer. It has a balance on it, in the case of my reader, way exaggerated, up to $30,000 in outstanding debt, which the reader did not have.
Huh.
And it kind of basically implies in so many words that if you don't contact us and start—
You're in trouble.
Right, yeah, you're going to face a whole world of you-know-what. And that's spooky. And so I called this company. And I asked, what's the deal with this? Well, Credit Arbitrators, like so many other companies, employs a third-party marketing firm. And that marketing firm uses hard sell tactics. And that's what's happening here. And in answer to Doug's question, yup, they get people's contact information from the credit reporting agencies.
What?
Yup.
How can they do that? I felt a bit violated.
You should. And not one of us has told Equifax, Experian, or TransUnion, yes, it's okay if you keep records about me.
Yeah.
None of us have given that approval. And yet they do it. And they have extreme control over our finances as a result. Well, one way that they leverage this enormous asset, in other words, the amount of data that they have collected on millions of citizens, is to sell some of this data to so-called list brokers. Yes, there are such things. Those list brokers, in turn, hawk the information to whoever would pay for it.
Well, so what is Doug supposed to do about this?
Yes, ignore it. If you want to be proactive, what you do is step up and try and get off of mailing lists. So, for instance, you could contact Credit Arbitrators and say, I do not want to receive any more mailings from you. You can also do things like contact the Direct Mail Association and ask them to put you on their list of do not solicit. But word of warning, you're going to have to give your Social Security number to do that.
Jeez.
So a lot of people are shy about that, and rightly so.
All right. So what do you think? Are you going to call these guys?
Well, no, I wasn't. I mean, the second thing that appalled me is that they were going to charge me a fee, I assumed, to even use a service.
12%. So let's say you've got $10,000 worth of debt. You'll have to pay an extra $1,200 for these guys to try to reduce it. And sometimes they can be successful because creditors oftentimes will think that it's better to get something than nothing. But sometimes they're not successful. And do you want to pay money to reduce money is what it comes down to. And it's a tricky game.
All right. Thanks. It's been fun and good luck.
Okay. Thanks so much. I enjoy the podcast. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. Our next caller is Richard, and he is in Hollywood, Florida. Hey there.
Hi, Tess. Hi, David.
Hey.
What do you do there in Hollywood?
I'm a graphic designer for a nonprofit organization.
Oh, what kind of nonprofit?
An opera company.
Opera company, lovely.
Do you sing?
I do sing, but I do not sing opera.
Do you? Okay, so I can't ask you to do Traviata or anything like that right now.
No.
So how can we help you out today?
I have a severely underwater house that I've been grappling with.
Oh, no. Well, yeah, welcome to Florida, right?
Yeah, exactly. My mortgage is at about $209,000, and the property appraiser puts a value of about $62,000 on it.
Underwater. You're Jacques Cousteau.
I like the house. I'm not crazy about my neighborhood. I don't know. I've heard this kind of described as a toxic asset.
Yeah, I would say that's safe to say that it's a toxic asset.
So I was declined for a loan modification about a year ago because I wasn't delinquent, and I've seen an attorney about possibly doing a short sale where I would be absolved of any debt at the end. These are the couple of options I know about. I was just wondering if you had any advice.
Well, there's the third option. That's walking away. One thing, Richard, is you're dealing with two things that it seems like the banking world does not want to help you with. I mean, there's the loan mod,
right,
first of all. The banks say that they're open to these. I don't know any that does them. I mean, the number of loan mods, successful loan mods that I've heard about from consumers, I mean, you can count them on one hand,
right,
practically.
Right.
Which is sad, because if we want to work through this problem, somebody is going to take that proverbial haircut.
Yep.
And more than likely, it's the banking industry. And, you know, let's face it, they can afford it.
Well, and you would think that they would want at least to be able to keep a homeowner in the home paying something on
as
it rather than having it empty.
Right. Or adding to the glut of foreclosed homes that
right
are on the market, which just add to their problems.
But logic apparently is not at play here.
Logic, not a big thing in the banking world, it turns out.
Yep.
And then the short sale. You would think that banks would be amenable to short sales as well. Again, it's better to get something than nothing.
Right. So have you thought about what you want to do? I mean, as David mentioned, a lot of people are just simply walking away from their mortgages. Of course, then you get into the whole, you know, morality issue of whether that's appropriate or not.
And they hit to your credit score.
And they hit to your credit score, certainly.
Years.
When we're talking about walking away, are we talking about foreclosure?
Ultimately, it ends up in a foreclosure. But what you do is basically tell the bank, I'm leaving the house.
Adios.
Bye.
And here's the keys.
Yep.
And I'm out of here. And essentially what you're saying is I'm making no more payments on this house. You can foreclose on it. You can party in it. You can do whatever you want. It's your house now. And you walk away. And as far as the credit world is concerned, you're going to look like a scofflaw. You're going to take a big hit to your credit file.
It is a foreclosure in your credit file.
And you know, it's bad. On the other hand, as Tess says, so many people have faced the same situation you are. And in fact, you are deeper underwater than I've heard from a lot of people in a while.
So there are these options for you. It seems to me that if the bank isn't going to work with you, you either stay in the house and keep paying your mortgage on a house that's underwater, or you choose not to pay.
Mm.
For walking away, though, am I absolved of a debt?
It depends on what kind of state you're in, and I would have to look this up, whether Florida is what's called a non-recourse state. There are several states, California is one of them, where if you walk away, the bank cannot come after you for the rest of the money that you owe them, technically, whether it's a short sale or a foreclosure.
And that's because...
But there are lots of states where you may end up having to pay.
But typically, your house is essentially collateral. And if you can't pay your mortgage, they take your house. That's the deal. So when you walk away, what you're doing is handing back the house, and there it is. And that should probably be the end of it, except for the deep hole you've dug for yourself on your credit score.
Is there a difference between walking away and just staying in the house and not paying it, like so many people I know are doing?
Yeah, it's logistics.
Yeah.
That's all it is. What it means is, under one scenario, you're walking away under your terms. On the other scenario, you're waiting for the sheriff to come.
Yeah. You're squatting in your own home.
It's the same credit hit either way.
Big time.
Okay. Yes.
All right. I really appreciate your advice.
All right. Hey, would you let us know what you end up doing?
I will. I absolutely will.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All right. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can send us an email at the Getting Personal link on our website. It's marketplace.org. David, thanks. It's been fun as always.
Thank you.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. Well, we've answered some of your questions here in this segment, but before we leave you, dear listener, we'd like to reach into the Marketplace Money mailbag and see what you've been saying about our show recently. And joining me to help do that is our senior producer, Patty Hirsch.
Hello, Tess.
Welcome back to the studio.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So how are people feeling about the show? Are they liking it? Not liking it?
Yeah, I think they're liking it. We got a well-stuffed mailbag this week. I was pretty impressed with the response to some of the stories there last week.
Good. Well, what are folks saying?
Well, I mean, so there's a lot of positive, some a little negative.
Okay.
And I think one of the ones that attracted my eye first was a letter from Roger Porzig from Orange Park in Florida. He says, Tess is on our soapbox again. It's absurd to limit the amount you put into a retirement fund.
That's what I said.
Apparently. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I did. I got on my soapbox last week in our call-in segment. Someone wondering why there was a limit on the amount of money that you can put in a retirement fund, a 401k retirement fund, we will point out, which is pre-tax.
Well, let's actually hear what you did actually say on the air, Tess.
The key here is that the limit is on your pre-tax income. But there's nothing that says you can't set aside in a savings account or in a brokerage account, any amount of money that you choose to.
Right. So we just want to set the record straight here.
I did say that.
Exactly. We are big supporters of not limiting the amount of money that you put into a retirement fund. You should save as much as you can.
Right. And you may not be able to put every dollar that you want to put away in a pre-tax account, a 401k or an IRA. But as I just said from last week, there's no limit on what you can put in after-tax savings vehicles.
All right. So
and in fact, we encourage you to do both.
Max it out if you can.
All right. What's next?
there was a very popular story that we did, which was the Forget You Fund, which is when you spoke to Meg Favreau of Wisebread.com.
That's right. That was a lot of fun. I love having her on the show. And you know, I know from Facebook that we have a lot of friends on Facebook who very much enjoyed that. Peter Young said that he and his colleague have both been in a group for nearly 15 years, and they've been saving aggressively the whole time. And they use the term, well, they say F-U money. Is how they say it. The letter F and the letter U.
Right. So while we're on this subject, we had a letter from Kristen O'Brien of St. Paul, Minnesota, who objected to Meg's, shall we say, potty mouth. She didn't like the phrase that she had. We sort of leavened it and called it the Forget You Fund, but she used another term that Kristen wasn't too happy about.
She did. Okay. Well, we will bear that in mind, but I think most folks seem to enjoy that particular segment. I did want to point out, actually related to that, that one of my followers on Twitter, Ron Firetag, or as I know him, at Ron Supports You. We all go by, you know, our first name is At.
Why don't you just call himself At Firetag? That's a great handle. Wow.
I like it. He supports me. Well, but anyway, he pointed out, and I don't know if you know this, that Humphrey Bogart actually was famous for having a, shall we call it, a Forget You Fund. Did you know that?
I did not know that, no.
I didn't either. And
did he need one?
Well, apparently he did, but he actually did not call it that. He called it the other name.
Mm. Okay.
That we will not mention. But apparently he said that, and this is quoting here, the only reason to have money is to tell any SOB in the world to go to hell. Well, I should probably say H-E double toothpicks.
Okay. While we're on the subject of the Forget You Fund, Mike Neve of Denver, Colorado wrote in. He questioned whether or not $1,000 is a good enough emergency fund. In what century was that, he said? Make it $10,000.
Oh, boy.
Well, I think, you know, Meg wasn't saying that $1,000
is all you need.
Yeah. I mean, I think immediately afterwards she said, once you've got $1,000 in the bank, put another $1,000 in there. I think she's just saying it's a stepping stone.
It is a stepping stone. And I think when we suggest numbers, make them something that the majority of the audience can handle, at least as a starting point.
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, have difficulty saving.
If you can start with $1,000, that is a great place to start. Absolutely wonderful. See if you can do that and then build from there.
Start small, climb high.
Exactly. Oh, I like that. I'm going to use that. All right. Well, we thank you all for writing in. Please continue to do so. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. We can take it.
Keep coming. Yep.
Thank you so much, Patty.
It's a pleasure, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Most of us understand the importance of paying our debts on time and in full. But what if we didn't? Or I should say, what if we didn't have to? Commentator Tim Bedore imagines a world in which debt is simply wiped out.
The other day, I heard an anthropologist saying that throughout history, when there's a huge disparity like we have today between the money the rich have and the money the poor have, forgiving debt is the only way to get things back on track. And even though I have no academic training in these matters, I want to weigh in and say, yes, he's right. Let's get the world to agree to relieve all debt. All toxic assets are off the books throughout those old spreadsheets. And while this is unfair to frugal people like me who played by the rules, to get our economy churning, we need a giant worldwide do-over. To help sell this to us frugal people who did not get underwater, we will be allowed to forcibly swap our houses for a bigger one with someone who did. I'm looking at a place on a nearby lake that the guy who invented the automatic bread maker with an iPod docking station had to walk away from. For what is money? It's merely an agreement. A gallon of gas is worth X. Can of Coke is one-third X. As a comedian, I will tell X amount of jokes for X amount of money because somewhere in the neighborhood of X makes it worth my while to leave my house. Money is not an arbitrary number, but it's certainly a ballpark thing. So if money is a flexible concept, why can't we reconcept where it all is and start the game over again? Unlike Monopoly, our money should remain all one color, otherwise no one would take it seriously. I know this sounds like absurd comic relief, but what I just said seems more like what we actually end up doing than anybody who went to lots of college and opines regularly on this stuff cares to admit, except for that anthropologist and now me.
Tim Bedore is a stand-up comedian living in Minneapolis. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Write to us at marketplace.org/money, or you can always post on our Facebook page. So complete debt forgiveness isn't likely unless you go through bankruptcy or maybe a short sale. But this week, the American Banker magazine reported that J.P. Morgan Chase appears to be backing off efforts to collect unpaid credit card debt from its customers. They're not forgiving the debt, but they've quietly stopped going after it. We're going to talk about this with Christopher Whalen, a banking industry analyst with Tangent Capital Partners in New York. Thanks for helping us out today.
Thank you.
Describe for us what you know of what exactly is going on here. It sounds like basically we may be looking at a robo-signing problem with credit card collections.
Yeah, it seems, based on the news reports I've read, that there may be some process issues here similar to what you had with the mortgages. In other words, you go into court and you say, you owe me money. And the judge says, okay, are you the person that's entitled to collect on the loan? And the bank says yes. And they file affidavits and everything else, which was the problem we had with robo-signing. In many courts, in New York, for example, the person with primary knowledge of the loan has to actually sign off on the affidavit. And you may not have that person available if you're the bank, right?
Right.
And what that means is that you may not, in fact, be able to pursue the claim. And you may not be able to assign it to a third party like a collection agency and have them pursue the claim.
So we're not seeing forgiveness of this credit card debt. What we're seeing is that they're backing off collection efforts.
Precisely. It's much like the same issue you have with a mortgage. If you can't prove that you are the person or the institution that's legally entitled to enforce the claim, you can't do it. Here in New York, the head of the court system made it clear to all lawyers, don't file any more foreclosure papers unless they're perfect. So the same thing applies on credit cards.
So what does that mean for customers of J.P. Morgan Chase who have credit cards? It does not mean that you can stop paying your debt, right?
Oh, no. I think what it means is that those individuals who are in the unfortunate position of being behind on their debts may, in fact, have a much more complex situation facing them than they may think. And it may or may not allow them to get out from under those debts.
You know, I wonder, not to be too cynical about it, but I wonder if the consumer looks at this and says, hey, look, you know, I stopped paying my mortgage and then the bank couldn't prove that it was able to come collect from me.
Correct.
And now I have credit card debt that the bank wants, but it can't prove that it can come collect from me. What are you supposed to think about this?
I think what it tells us as a society is that there is no free lunch. And if the banks are going to be out making loans and doing so in a very sloppy and haphazard fashion, then they can expect to take losses.
Well, then maybe the free lunch is for the consumer.
I think that's right. And, you know, there is a libertine thread in American society and history where getting out from under debt has always been seen as good. Something for nothing, as the song says, right?
Right. Is there any room here anywhere for sympathy with the banks and its investors?
Oh, of course not. No, I think there should be sympathy for the investors because they may have been the subjects of fraud. And many of them are already in the courts suing their advisors and suing banks for fraud in the mortgage sector. You could see similar actions in credit cards if, as some of the news reports have suggested, the banks can't collect on them. So this isn't done yet. We're going to probably be talking about this for a couple of years.
I wonder what would happen, as we just heard our commentator kind of proposing in a very humorous way. What would happen if all of a sudden we just all started with a clean slate?
What, we declare the Jubilee and return all property?
Yes, or perhaps the apocalypse, I don't know.
Well, the thing you have to remember is that somebody does bear the loss. Mm-hmm. And so if you start imposing those kinds of losses on banks, they're going to stop making loans, and it's going to hurt the economy. If the Fed monetizes a lot of debt, as they are already doing, that shows up in terms of inflation at the grocery counter.
Christopher Whalen, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Personal finance guru Susie Orman debuted a new TV show this week. It's called Money Class on Oprah Winfrey's network. It's kind of a money makeover on steroids with a studio audience. And she also introduced her own prepaid debit card. Well, that card prompted quite a dust-up on Twitter this week after Orman called some personal finance bloggers idiots for questioning some of the card's fees. She eventually issued a blanket apology. We asked her to join us to talk about the card and also answer some questions you posted for her on our Facebook page. Susie Orman, welcome back to the program.
Aw, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
I want to talk about your new prepaid debit card that was announced this week. Why did you decide you wanted to get into this business?
As you know, there is an entire group of people, the unbanked and the underbanked, that are growing. There's 70 million of them right now that are literally using these prepaid debit cards. The fact of the matter is, if you look at the majority of the prepaid cards that are out there, they absolutely charge exorbitant fees. So I decided, number one, that was absolutely ludicrous, that people should not have to pay large sums of money just to be able to have the privilege of using a card. Next, I wanted to change the scoring mechanism system. I wanted to make it so that people who used debit cards eventually got credit towards their credit scores. And that's what we're doing. This is the first prepaid card in history that is sharing information with TransUnion, a major credit bureau. It will be 18 to 24 months before TransUnion and hopefully the other credit bureaus will join us on this, that they will be able to determine if debit card behavior can predict future credit card use.
CardHub.com did an analysis of your card versus the Green Dot card as well as the Amex card. And the one knock it did have is that there are so many different fees on your card, 20 versus 8 for the Green Dot and only one fee for the Amex card.
Oh, please, girlfriend, don't tell me you that are that naive. There is no way Amex has just one fee. There is no way Green Dot just has four or five fees. The person that did that article doesn't even know how to evaluate cards, let alone be good enough to be able to give a determination on it. The reason that they were able to see all the fees that we could potentially charge if you don't use the card the way that we tell you is because by law, you have to have them. And the only difference is we're showing everybody the fees. We're being transparent. All those other cards, you do your homework. You try to find their fees. You try to find how much it really is going to cost you. You're not going to be able to because they are hidden deep, deep into the site. Are you kidding me? He was an idiot.
Are you concerned at all that your audience might question you having a card like this, perhaps making money off of them, however little, while at the same time counseling them on their money management?
I don't think so, because the people who have been listening to me now for almost 30 years, they know that I have earned their trust. They know that I have never put my needs in front of theirs. So I don't personally care what other people say because I know what I'm doing and the people who follow me know what I'm doing as well. And we will just see who has the last laugh when it comes to the approved card.
Well, I was hoping we could have just a little bit of fun before we conclude our conversation here. We asked some of our friends on Facebook what questions they would have for you. So would you mind answering a couple of those?
You got it.
All right. Well, first, what are some of the biggest changes in your own views on personal finance since you started this part of your career?
You know, I would have told you years ago, absolutely fund your 401k plan to the absolute maximum allowed. Today, I wouldn't tell you to do so. Today, I would tell you only fund your 401k plan up to the point of the match. After the match, if you qualify, you should be doing a Roth IRA. If your 401k plan doesn't match at all, you shouldn't be contributing to your 401k plan. You should absolutely be doing a Roth IRA instead.
Well, here's another question from Facebook. You know, lots of folks set financial goals at the start of this new year. They might assume your finances are in pretty tip-top shape, but did you set any goals for yourself for the year?
You know, I didn't set any goals for myself. I set this year as the year that I launched the approved card and that I didn't take any speaking engagements. I have this whole year clear. Because the one thing that I want to see happen before I retire, and I do plan on retiring in about 3 years from now, And when that happens, I want to know that I have left my mark on this world in a way that probably no other personal finance person ever would have done. And that is, I want debit card usage to be able to create a credit score so that when children go to college, they don't have to get a credit card just so they can have a credit score. So that maybe one day credit cards become obsolete and we could return to a cash society, albeit on plastic, but that debit plastic gives people credit for the future. And if I can do that, then that will be a great goal for Miss Orman to finally say, bye-bye, I'm going fishing.
Well, I got to pick up on that. Boy, 3 years. Tell us what a Susie Orman retirement looks like.
Yeah, I have a goal there. In 3 years, I'll be 63, almost 64. And so at that point in time, I want to go around the world on a boat. I want to go around the world on a boat that I help captain. So I don't want to go on a cruise ship. I want to feel what it feels like to live on a boat, go around the world with KT, who's my life partner. And girlfriend, don't bet against me of that goal not coming true.
You mentioned your life partner, and on Facebook, we also had two related questions about same-sex couples.
Yeah.
And they both ask, basically, what's the best way to maximize any economic benefits that you do have as a couple, even if your union isn't recognized by your local, state, and federal government?
Yeah. It's very, very sad because even if you are recognized, you're married in the state that maybe you happen to be living in, on a federal level, there is no recognition at all.
Right.
So I think it's very important, number one, that you keep money very equal between the two of you so we never know who's going to go first, but that you want to make sure that the other partner is absolutely set if something happens. So, for instance, I have a lot more money than KT does, but if I die, KT is going to have to owe estate taxes. A lot of the money that we have is wrapped up in real estate. So I don't want KT to have to liquidate the real estate in order to pay the estate taxes or use up all the money that we have in municipal bonds or whatever it may be. So I carry a very hefty insurance policy on myself where KT is the owner, I am the insured, but KT is the beneficiary. So if I die, it's not included in my estate, but it will be more than enough money to pay the estate tax so KT does not have to sell anything or change her lifestyle at all. Those are the types of planning mechanisms that you can put into effect now so that you know everything it should go the way it should. And you really want to make sure that you have set up not only a will, but you need a living revocable trust with an incapacity clause in it so that if something physically happens to one of you, the other can sign for you in case you can't do it for yourself. Those are just a few of the things that you should have in place.
Susie Orman, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And finally to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Livingston, Montana, and the home of 35-year-old James Willich. I asked our friends on Facebook and Twitter for piggy nominations this week. James wrote, and I quote, "I want a piggy because after 44-plus months of unemployment, the curse is broken and now I can start saving again. Yippee!" That's what he said. His post got a whole bunch of likes, so I called him up to get his story.
I was on unemployment for a little while, and that ran out, and then my wife supported me, and I decided to go back to school and get another degree, an engineering degree this time. We'll see if that can turn into something a little more stable than construction and real estate and all that.
So was it a layoff for you?
Yeah, I was timber framer for a company in Bozeman.
Well, of course, as you know, you're certainly not alone in going through this kind of long-term unemployment. But for those who are still in that situation, do you have maybe one or two pieces of advice for how you got through it for that length of time?
You know, Tess, it's really, really, really difficult to keep a positive mindset. You know, the first couple of months of being unemployed is kind of like, look for a job, but it's not that bad. But once you start to really get into long-term unemployment, it's kind of grates on you and it bears down on you more and more and more. And I guess just the best advice I can give is just, you know, keep your head up, keep looking, whittle down your costs as much as you can. My wife and I have a big garden in our yard, so you know, all of our, you know, food and whatnot that we grow during the summertime, we eat in the winter because we can. And, and just, you know, if it's a short-term thing, you know, you'll be all right. If it's a long-term thing, you'll find out where your priorities lie. Keep paying the people that you have to pay, and then the rest of them just fall by the wayside.
Well, let's end with the good news. What are you going to be doing?
Well, this year I have, I believe, a year and a half to 2 years left on a mechanical engineering degree, and I currently work for a transportation institute as a student researcher.
And you're paid for it?
Yeah, I can start to, you know, buy my daughter a birthday present.
All right. Well, you can do that, hopefully, with the pennies and quarters that you're going to save up, because we're going to be sending you a pig.
Hot diggity. I'm glad I can finally have something to put in it.
I am, too. Congratulations on the job, and best of luck to you.
Thanks, Tess. Boing, boing.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Our show is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Sasha Woodruff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.